Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Okay, buenas tardes. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming to our conference on marking the 40th anniversary of the East LA student blowouts or walkouts 40 years ago in 1968. I'm Mario Garcia, professor of Chicana and Chicano Studies at UCSB, and the convener of the Chicano Latino Research Focus Group, the main sponsor of this afternoon's conference. Before I introduce the conference, let me just remind you to turn off your cell phones, especially because we are videotaping the proceedings. Also because we're taping the conference, if you could avoid blocking the view of the cameras in the center aisles. Okay, all cell phones off? I better check mine. All right. 40 years ago, in early March of 1968, thousands of courageous Chicano students in the East Los Angeles public schools walked out of their schools in what came to be called the blowouts. Led by an equally courageous Chicano teacher by the name of Sal Castro, these students took it upon themselves to try to correct years of segregated and inferior education in what had historically been referred to as the Mexican schools. These protests were not the first concerning the Chicano struggle for educational justice in this country, but they were the most dramatic and significant. The blowouts not only commenced the urban Chicano movement of that era, complementing the farm worker struggle led by Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta, but the walkouts would also have long-range implications that we are still the inheritors of today. While many of the school problems that the blowouts addressed have not been fully eradicated, a number of reforms have nevertheless followed the 1968 demonstrations. Not the least was the effort by the students who walked out to get their schools to begin a more concerted effort to encourage and help Chicano and Latino students to go on to college. In turn, colleges and universities also began to more aggressively recruit Chicano and Latino students. This is part of the legacy of the blowouts. All of us of Chicano Latino ancestry have benefited in one form or another from the impact of the blowouts and other educational reforms that followed from them. But this inheritance is only one part of the legacy of the walkouts. The other is a reminder that the struggle for educational justice has to continue among the new generation of Chicano Latino students. While this conference marks and honors the 40th anniversary of the historic East LA blowouts, the most important way to honor this anniversary is by continuing la lucha. The struggle continues. I'd like to, because some of you may not be staying for the 4 hours from 2 to 6 for the conference, I want to introduce, especially for those of you that may have to leave early, the reason that we're all here in commemorating the 40th anniversary of the walkouts, which in my opinion is the principal instigator, if you will, the principal key figure in the walkouts, and that is, of course, the figure of Sal Castro. So I want to just briefly note that he's with us, obviously, here today, and so that people can know where Sal Castro is. And there he is right there. This conference could not have been organized without the support and assistance of various groups and individuals, and I'd like to acknowledge them now. First and foremost, I would like to give major thanks to Professor Carl Gutierrez Jones, the director, of the Chicano Research Institute, who, when I first approached him a year ago about organizing this conference, without hesitation and with much enthusiasm, expressed his support. Besides providing financial and logistical support, the Institute assisted in my obtaining a UC Mexis grant to support the conference. As a result, I want to express my gratitude to Professor Gutierrez Jones and his strong leadership at the Institute for supporting the conference. At the Institute, I also want to thank the assistance of Teresa Peña. Other key co-sponsors of the conference include UC Mexis, the Interdisciplinary Humanities Center, especially Manny Garcia for the great poster and flyer that he devised, the Department of Chicana and Chicano Studies, the Executive Vice Chancellor's Office, and my colleague in Chicano Studies, Professor Maria Herrera Sobeck, the Vice Chancellor for Diversity, Equity, and Academic Policy, and the Office of Academic Preparation and Equal Opportunity. I would also like to thank the various students from my two classes this quarter who volunteered to assist me in promoting the conference on campus and in helping to set up today. Additional thanks to one of my graduate students, Nick Santino, for making the successful effort to secure transportation for some of the high school students who will be joining us later in the conference. And finally, a special thanks to my graduate research assistant, Colleen Ho, whose assistance was indispensable. Let's give a big hand to all of these supporters. With these comments, let me now introduce, for some additional introductory remarks, the director of the Chicano Research Institute, Professor Carl Gutierrez-Jones.
It's an honor to be here, and especially an honor to be here with the people who made the blowouts such an important event that's affected all of us. I promise I'll keep my comments brief. I've managed to keep my notes on this one very small card. Although I am an English professor, so we'll see how that turns out. First of all, it really is a pleasure to be here celebrating and analyzing the blowouts, which of course have had such an enormous impact on the Chicano movement and on education. Certainly the Chicano Studies Institute that I now direct would not be in place were it not for the actions of the people that you'll be able to hear and speak with today. And one of the things that's so impressive about the actions that they undertook is that they happened in the context really of fear. One needs to, I think, look at the broader range, certainly the effects of the blowouts, but what came before. And here I'm thinking of the repatriation drives. I'm thinking of the servicemen's riots. I'm thinking of a lot of microaggressions that are never recorded unless it's in a memoir or in oral history. All of the reasons why somebody might not answer the call to tear down the fence and to walk and to protest. And that being just part of the picture, all the macroaggressions as well, all the ways in which people might find it more comfortable not to take the steps that they did. And you're going to hear a great deal about the sacrifices and the pain, families divided, these high school students not even being allowed back into their homes as they're in the midst of participating in these events. Extremely difficult time and not, not simply because of conflict between Chicano and non-Chicano community. The people who participated in these events surmounted that culture of fear, and they did so in a way that showed us one can step outside of one's individual concerns, and to do that, to come together as a community is a powerful thing, and I think it helps explain why the blowouts have a kind of mythic, almost mythic quality to them, the ability to inspire. It's why we are still talking about the blowouts today, why they're so important for the Chicano Latino community. And certainly they're a moment, that couple of weeks, it's a moment that we want to study, we want to learn from, and we want to be critical in analyzing those results. We want to think about all the things that grew out that were positive, and we want to think about the kinds of reforms even that weren't successful, and to try and learn and build. Again, I want to thank Mario Garcia and all that were participating to make this happen, but especially Mario, because this has been a labor of love for, as he said, at least a year. So, with that, I turn it back over to Mario. I hope that you enjoy the afternoon.
Let me note that there are three parts to the conference. First, I will present some of my oral history project on Sal Castro and the blowouts to be accompanied by two commentators, including Professor Mario Barrera sitting here at the table, and hopefully will be joined a bit later by Professor Tara Yoso of our Department of Chicano and Chicano Studies, and I'll introduce both of them at that time for their comments. Secondly, we'll have a panel composed of former high school and college students who participated in the walkouts, and who will share their memories and reflections about what happened 40 years ago. And finally, we'll conclude the conference with a keynote address by none other than Sal Castro. During the conference, we are providing some refreshments over here in this adjacent room. So we'll have a few. We'll have breaks between each section, and so you're all welcome to participate in the or to partake of those refreshments. And then, following Sal Castro's talk, we will have a reception here with some food and drink, and we'll also be entertained by UCSB's own Mariachi Integral de UCSB. And everyone is invited to stay for this. So let's move on to the first section, which is my presentation entitled Blowout, Sal Castro and the Chicano Struggle for Educational Justice. And let me preface it by saying that this is the result of a multi-year project that I started some maybe 10 years ago with Sal Castro in interviewing him to put down his story, his whole life story, but also, of course, very much featured on the seminal events of the walkouts, of the blowouts. And so we spent a long time, a number of years, working on this project. A year or so ago, during my sabbatical, I wrote up the initial drafts, and it's the book now is being reviewed for publication. As I say, it is Sal Castro's life story, which includes his coming of age in Los Angeles, going through the schools there, entering the military in the early 50s, coming back, getting married, having two children, beginning his college career at Cal State LA, participating in the 1960 presidential campaign, helping to organize voters in support of Senator Kennedy. His first teaching assignment was at Belmont High School in the early 60s. There he helped to organize some of the Chicano students in what was called the Tortilla Movement, which was an effort by the Chicano students there to organize among themselves to get, for the first time, get elected to their student council. They had been discriminated against. Sal helped them to do that, but he paid a price because he was on probation as a teacher, and within one semester they moved him out because of his role with the students. And they foolishly sent him to Lincoln High School, not knowing that he would cause even more havoc there. And so within a few years in talking with the students, and of course Sal knew about the problems in the schools and the discrimination and the lack of support by teachers and counselors, the high dropout rates, the low expectations by teachers, the low reading scores, all of these problems in the inner city schools, Sal was quite acquainted with them. And his students, of course, were also quite well acquainted with those problems. So over a period of some 3 years, this dialogue between Sal and the students, not only in Lincoln, but some of the other schools at the Mexican-American Youth Leadership Conferences, all of this came together so that by 1968, Sal and the students were ready for a dramatic action to bring to the attention of the Los Angeles Board of Education, the Los Angeles School Administration, and the larger Los Angeles community, the grievances of the Chicano Latino students and their community about the conditions of these schools. What I'm going to read in part to you is the first is chapter 6, which is entitled Blowout Part 1, to give you, and this is Sal Castro's voice. So when I'm reading, you can also look over at Sal and say, did he say that? It's Sal Castro's voice through me as the oral, as the historian, and through the avenue of oral history, conveying his voice as much as I could, although I've talked with Sal so much over the years in his interviews. He's come to speak to so many of my classes that, as I told my class the other day, sometimes I feel like I sound like Sal Castro. You know, I find myself, I said, does that sound just like Sal? But so let me share with you then some of Sal's reflections and memories about the events that led to the walkout, including the initial walkouts, and then we're going to turn to Professor Barrera and perhaps Professor Yoso for their comments on my presentation. So this is Sal Castro. We need to do something dramatic like Watts, I thought to myself following the riots in L.A. In 1965. I, of course, didn't support violence, but Watts showed me that only when minorities rebel or publicly resist in such a way to bring attention to their grievances would the rest of society listen. The problem affecting Mexicans in the LA schools was so severe and so damaging to our kids that some kind of explosion was needed. I didn't know what this would mean. All I knew was that without some kind of mass protest by the students, nothing would change. It was about this time that my father paid me one of his rare visits from Mazatlan. I had been very close to him. I had not been very close to him over the years, but he was, after all, my kid's grandfather. One day during his visit, I told him about all the problems in the schools and how frustrated I was, and I felt this weight on my shoulders to do something about it. But what? Huelga, he calmly said to me. Huelga. What do you mean, huelga? You mean a strike? Mijo, you know that after I went to Mazatlan, I helped to organize the railroad workers. You know that I was thrown in jail for this, but it was only by striking that the workers got changes for themselves. That's the only power that poor people have to organize and go on strike. Huelga, strike. I later thought about what my father had said, but how would this work with the kids? They're not going to strike. What do they do? Do they go to school and don't leave or not come to school? How do we work that? All this started me thinking about a plan of action, a strategy that could successfully be applied to the schools. I knew for sure that a mass action was needed, something like a strike, but the actual plan was something I started formulating in my mind for the next couple of years. In the meantime, things were happening in the Chicano community that in different ways inspired me and the students to seriously consider something big. For one, there was the example of Cesar Chavez and the farm workers. I think that the impact that Caesar had on me was that it made me realize that his struggle was predominantly in the fields, and his main constituents were farm workers. That was understandable. This was his fight. But he wasn't talking about people working in factories, sweatshops, and other places where Mexicans worked in the cities and lived in much larger numbers. Somehow the struggle had to also involve the urban barrios. This influenced my thinking about a dramatic action in the schools. There had to be an urban counterpart to Caesar's agricultural struggles. Because by 1967, there were a few more Chicano College students at UCLA, USC, LA State, East LA College, some of whom I knew because they were Lincoln graduates, such as Moctezuma Esparza, but also Al Juarez, Carlos Munoz, and Carl Vasquez, I first began to talk about a serious action in the schools with them. I met with some of these college kids to try to get them to volunteer to come to the schools to help the high school students to read better. As I met with them, I bounced my ideas about the need for something to happen. They responded positively. As products of these schools and survivors of them, they knew the problems and that things couldn't go on as usual. I expanded on my thoughts when some of the college students and a group called Young Citizens for Community Action, formed after the 1967 Camp Hess-Kramer Conference and led by Vicky Castro and David Sanchez, started the Piranha Coffee House on Olympic Boulevard and Atlantic on the east side. They rented an old abandoned warehouse. Ironically, today it's the site of a fancy Latino restaurant called Tamayos. I served on the first board of directors of the Piranha. They needed adults to help sign for the lease. In those days, everyone had a bohemian coffee house that had been the influence of the earlier beatnik movement of the late 50s and early 60s. These coffee houses were the precursors of Starbucks. Young people sat around drinking coffee and having long intellectual conversations or hearing poets read their stuff, although in my interview with Paula Crisóstomos, he said, I don't remember any coffee there. I don't think there was nothing to drink, nothing. They just talked. I knew both Vicky and David because both had attended one of the Camp Hess-Kramer conferences and were impressive young people. As a result of their experiences at the conference, they became more political. The Piranha became a central meeting place for many of the young Chicanos who became activists in the Chicano movement in L.A. As they became more involved, they invited various political speakers. I think Cesar Chavez spoke, as well as black radicals such as Stokely Carmichael. They asked me to speak. I talked about the need for a mass action in the schools, and I encouraged them to help when it came. I knew even then that if it came to such a protest that I would need the college students and the Brown Berets to help me with the younger kids. They were developing leaders, and I would need them. I concluded by saying, hey, stay tuned because we're going to do something. The kids are going to do something in the schools, and we're going to need your help. Let me just say a little bit about I mentioned the Camp Hess-Kramer conferences, and I won't read that section, but these were conferences that were started in 1963, first called the Mexican-American Youth Leadership Conferences, and Sal Castro very early got engaged with them. These were conferences that once, and then later 2 years, two times a year, brought in young high school students, mostly juniors, where they were, it was an attempt to create a sense of pride in their ethnic background, to give them a sense of ethnic identity, to introduce to them, for them to talk about the problems in the schools. And out of this, as I mentioned the other day in another talk, a dialogue developed between Sal Castro and these students who began to come to these conferences every year. And some of these students who would come, especially by the later 60s, like 1967, would be some of the students who would actually be involved in the walkouts and become leaders in the walkouts. So these youth leadership conferences were very crucial in understanding also the coming of the walkouts and Sal Castro's involvement with those events. Besides helping to promote a Chicano consciousness at the 1967 conference and of talking about a mass action, I used this occasion to develop an information network. I got as many phone numbers and addresses as I could, knowing that this would be crucial in organizing any protest that would involve kids not only at Lincoln, but throughout the East Side. This was before email and cell phones, so all I had was a handwritten list of these contacts, but they would come in handy. I left the 1967 conference knowing and feeling assured that the foundation for an action had been laid. The reason why kids were aware is because of the Camp Hess-Kramer experience. They knew what the problems were, and they knew that sooner or later something was going to happen. All that that was now needed was to decide on the protest and to begin to organizing it. As I began the new school year for 1967-68, I knew that the time had come. Throughout all of this period, I kept hearing my father's advice, huelga, huelga. Although I hadn't yet set the word strike to anyone, I had pretty much decided that I would organize a student strike, a huelga. But I decided not to use the word huelga or strike that were too labor-oriented. I decided that the students, if they were willing, would stage a walkout, not only from Lincoln, but also from all the other East Side schools, Roosevelt, Garfield, and Wilson. Belmont might also participate in this. I began to talk to people, including the students in the fall semester of 1967, and certainly by the beginning of the spring semester of 1968, of a massive walkout that would force school officials, including the Board of Education, to listen to the students' grievances. I didn't coin the word blowout. I had never heard of it before. It was some of the students who spontaneously came up with that term during the walkouts. So the plan was now to inform students and others about the specific idea of a walkout and to begin preparations for it. By early January 1968, commencing what La Raza newspaper would call the year of decision, I started the actual organizing of the walkouts. I informally met with some potential sympathetic teachers at the other schools. Some of the college students, like Al Juarez, participated in this. I also took some of my Lincoln students as seniors who supported the walkouts to meet at UCLA with the UMAS group, the United Mexican American Students, the precursor of the Mecha groups. So they went to meet at UCLA with some of the Chicano students there. Moctezuma Esparza, who had gone to Lincoln and graduated from Lincoln the year before, was now a leader of UMAS, and he served as a liaison between it and what I was doing. I told the college kids that if we walked out, that we would need their help, especially as monitors to help the high school students once they left the schools. I need your heads, I told the college students. Yeah, they responded, we can help plan strategy and develop other ideas. No, pendejos, I said, I need your heads in case the cops come down on the students. I need your heads to get in the way and take the blows. They laughed and understood. The Brown Berets by 1968, led by David Sanchez and Carlos Montes, had already organized. Some were college students and some were not, but they focused on community issues through their educational programs, community newspaper called La Causa, free breakfast programs, health clinic, and their monitoring of police abuse. I had already made contacts with them at the Piranha, but I increased them now that I had a specific plan. Another important group involved in the emerging Chicano underground was the emerging underground press, such as La Raza and Inside East Side. La Raza's publisher and editor was a militant Cuban-American by the name of Erizar Risco, who had worked with the farm workers before coming to L.A. to start his newspaper. I met with him and Raul Reese, one of his assistants, and informed them about the walkout idea and that I needed them at the right time to serve as part of my information network to get the word out, especially to the students, about the walkout. They agreed, and Raul later, after also working with Inside East Side, on his own, published another paper called Chicano Student News and later called Chicano Student Movement, aimed specifically at the high school students. Both papers had high school reporters from the different schools who helped distribute the paper to the students. In addition to meeting with these several groups, I also organized an informal working committee. It consisted of some teachers and students from each of the schools. The high school students themselves organized strike committees at Roosevelt, Lincoln, and Garfield. We met at a private residence in the barrio. Each teacher usually brought about 5 students, as I did. The numbers varied from meeting to meeting. Tony Ortiz, for example, a teacher at Roosevelt, brought his students. Some college students like Al Juarez and Montezuma Esparza also attended. I had about 50 to 60 college students through the various UMAS chapters that I could rely on, and these now included additional schools such as San Fernando State and Long Beach State. Of the high school kids that came to these meetings, they in the end didn't surface as the key leaders. They supported the walkouts, but as the movement grew, other students emerged as leaders such as Paula Crisostomo at Lincoln and Mita Cuaron at Garfield. At these meetings, we discussed strategy, but also the demands that we would make. The demands included many of the issues that the students had discussed at the Camp Hess-Kramer conferences, as well as the problems I had witnessed at Lincoln. I want to make it very clear that I was not alone in organizing the students in the East Side schools. I couldn't have done it without the assistance of some of the Chicano College students and some in the community. They were the backbone of the walkouts. Of course, the high school and even junior high school students were part of this movement. The blowouts were a collective effort. In planning the walkouts, I kept to myself a deep, dark secret. Yes, I felt that something like the walkouts was needed to shake things up, and I was prepared to go through with it. But what I really wanted was to bluff the school board and school officials. I wanted to use the threat of a mass student civil disobedience as a way of forcing them to listen to the kids and to change their attitudes and practices about our students. I thought that a bluff would be sufficient to achieve our objectives, but I also did fear that if we carried out this protest of what might happen to the kids and their safety. In the back of my mind was the Watts riots of 1965 and how the police and military came down on blacks with unneeded force that killed and wounded a large number. The last thing I wanted was a similar reaction to the walkouts. So my hope was just to get the word out that a mass walkout was in the works as a way of bluffing school officials to fear this action and to move to prevent it by negotiating with the students. I even mentioned to my principal that this might be coming down. "You better not get involved with this, Sal," he warned me. I took it as an implied threat, but smiled at him. I also told the students at the different schools that they should tell their principals that something big like a walkout might occur. But a bluff can only work if people really believe that what you're planning on doing is likely to happen. Believing this, I deliberately told no one, including my students, that deep down I hoped that we could bluff our way into making the changes desired. But nothing was guaranteed. It was a bit spooky. My idea was that we wouldn't spring, no pun intended, into action until May. By then, we would have the demands ready and we would approach the schools and the school board. I figured that the threat of a walkout in the late spring would be more effective because it would put pressure on the schools as they got ready for final exams and for graduation. The other factor in planning for a May bluff or possible action was that by May, the kids would be very tired of school and it wouldn't take much for them to want to leave school. A lot of kids might be failing their classes and looking for places to go. This attitude wasn't the kids' fault because many teachers stupidly and callously told students who flunked their midterms that there was no way that they could pass the class anyway. So they deprived the students of any motivation of continuing in these classes. I figured that by May, we'd have plenty of kids that would walk out. And of course, May brings even nicer weather to LA, and I didn't want the walkouts if they occurred to be rained out. As we entered the spring season in early March, I remained confident that everything was going pretty much as planned and that we would succeed in bluffing the schools. It didn't quite happen that way. One of the East Side schools that would be involved in the walkouts was Wilson. Some of the students there had been working with me in planning the action. At the same time, school life went on as usual. Students went to classes, they played sports, they went to dances, they put on plays. The play that some of the kids at Wilson were involved in that spring was called Barefoot in the Park, a popular Broadway play that had been also made into a movie with Jane Fonda and Robert Redford. Wilson also had a very conservative principal by the name of Mr. Donald Skinner. He was so conservative that he wore suspenders to hold his pants up. No one dressed like that in 1968. It appears that on Thursday, February 28th, he went to the final dress rehearsal of the play to give his approval for the play to go on that weekend. One of the lines of the play involves the young married couple after they've returned to their New York apartment after their honeymoon. The guy says to his wife, "Shall we go to work today or go back to bed?" When Skinner heard this, he apparently became quite irate and immediately canceled the play. "No, no, this play is not going to be shown here at Wilson," I later heard that he said. He closed the damn play down. The kids in the play, all Chicanos, were pissed. They had been working hard for weeks and looked forward to performing. None of these students were part of the Wilson contingent that had been coming to our planning meetings on the walkouts, but they had heard the rumors about the possible protest. So they picked up on this, and that Friday, March the 1st, they led other students on a walkout at Wilson. It was a pretty large group of perhaps between 300 and 400. The media picked it up. The students protested the closing of the play, but it coincided with other problems at the school affecting Mexican-American students. But Wilson's walkout wasn't part of our plan. It took our organizing committee and me by surprise. I didn't hear about it until it happened. We hadn't planned on any action until May, and all of a sudden we have Wilson already walking out. On top of this, there went our bluff. The walkouts had started. Monday, March 4th, and Tuesday, March 5th, we continued to meet to coordinate the action. Everything seemed to be moving smoothly, except that on Tuesday, the students at Garfield High also jumped the gun and walked out. The Los Angeles Times reported that the principal complained that for more than a week prior to the demonstration, that leaflets urging the walkouts had been circulated. This was the work of the Garfield Strike Committee. The Chicano Press later reported that about 2,000 students walked out. My understanding of the Garfield walkout was that the students' leaders there had become tired of waiting for our demands to be presented to the school board. However, it only stressed to me the importance of now definitely going out the next day and for my committee and me to assert our leadership. What was disturbing about the Garfield walkout and that raised possible problems was that the police intervened, declared the walkout an unlawful assembly, and roughed up some of our students. I had feared such a police overreaction, but was not prepared for it with the spontaneous Garfield walkout. The walkout at Garfield gave us no choice now but to get back in control and immediately get the other schools to also walk out. I knew it would have to be that very next day. I called an emergency meeting that Tuesday afternoon at Raul Ariola's house in El Sereno. Raul was an art teacher at one of the schools and prominent in the American Federation of Teachers. I got the word out to some of the college students, a few of the teachers at the other schools, and a few parents. I deliberately wanted to keep the meeting small in order to make sure that we agreed on a strategy. I want to skip ahead. Sal meets with the college kids, and they plan the strategy for the larger walkouts on that Wednesday. And all of the college kids were assigned to each of the schools. Very important for Sal was to alert the media that the walkouts were going to take place. He understood, as many in the 60s understood, that if it wasn't shown on television, it might as well not have happened. So he assigned Moctezuma Esparza, who had graduated from Lincoln and was now at UCLA. Moctezuma Esparza would later go on to become, as some of you know, film producer and so forth, was already interested in working with the media. And so Moctezuma was assigned to tell the media of the strategy. Part of that strategy was that Lincoln would walk out the next day at 10 o'clock. Roosevelt would walk out at noon. The other two schools would walk out in between. But the importance of the time factor was that it would give the media the opportunity to cover the first walkout at Lincoln at 10 and then give them the time to go over to Roosevelt and cover that. The problem was that Moctezuma's head was somewhere else at the time. He didn't remember, and so he told the media that the walkouts were at noon. So this is to be kept in mind as the events of the next day began to unfold. And, of course, the rest of the day was everyone was calling each other. Signs were being made, the picket signs and so forth, to be ready. The college students and the Brown Berets were brought in, although Sal told the Brown Berets, yes, I need you there to protect the kids, but I don't want you coming with your semi-military uniforms because you're going to spook the kids. You're going to be looking like Che Guevara. I can't have that going on, you know. And so here is Sal's recollections of the initial day on Wednesday where all of the schools went out. He says, I didn't get much sleep that Tuesday night. By then I was living by myself after my divorce, so I couldn't even confide in my wife. I woke up even earlier than usual and got ready to go to school. I think I was too anxious and nervous to think about the historical importance of this day. I just knew that it had to be done. As I drove into the school parking lot, everything seemed normal as usual. It was a bit hazy that morning, March 6th, as LA mornings tend to be, but it proved to be a nice early spring day. No rain, thank God, I said to myself. As I entered the main building, I ran into some of our students' organizers. Okay, this is it, we're going, I told them. For weeks, some of them almost every day had been asking me, today, Mr. Castro? Well, this time I said, yeah, today. Instead of going directly to my classroom, I went to see George Engels, the principal. This was deliberate. I wanted to tell him what was going to happen. I wanted to make sure that he would tell the police that this was going to be a peaceful demonstration and that they should not come on campus. I also wanted him to inform the other school principals to do the same. As he had before, he warned me, Sal, don't do this. George, I'm going out with the students. As I left his office and walked to my class, I told the other students that we were walking out at 10 a.m. Is it true, Mr. Castro, we're going? Yeah, get ready. They were ready and eager. We had done a good job, thanks to our student leaders, as well as the Chicano Underground Press, of getting the word out. The students in general knew the problems of the schools. My first class that morning was U.S. history, and my second was guidance, something new I was doing. I didn't talk about the walkout in class because all the students already knew about it. I couldn't do much with them that morning. Their minds were elsewhere. They kept looking at the clock and looking out the windows. Those first two class sessions seemed to take on forever. We could have organized the action earlier, but I wanted to wait at Lincoln until 10 that morning when all of the students went to homeroom at 10. Teachers took attendance at that time, and this was important because school funding was based on attendance. I wanted to hit the school right in the pocketbook by having the kids go out prior to homeroom and before attendance could be taken. 9:50 a.m. Ring, ring. At first, nothing happened. Am I really going to do this? One of the students, Patsy Valdez, later recalled. Then all of a sudden, kids started to go out. I could hear the shuffling in the halls. Some of them went to their lockers where they had hidden their homemade signs. As students began to exit, some of the college kids and berets entered the main building and started calling out to the students, walk out, walk out. I didn't see them, and that had not been part of the plan, so it was spontaneous on their part. Actually, I didn't want the college students and the berets to go in and do this because I didn't want to spook the kids. The high school students didn't know them, and I was concerned that this might scare them. Fortunately, the high school kids had it together and walked out on their own without panicking. I didn't see the college students and the berets in the hall because my classroom was in the southern end of the campus and not in the main building. Besides, I was too busy getting my students out of the school. As the kids left the building, they also shouted, walk out, walk out. They didn't use the term blowout, or at least I didn't hear it. The origins of the term was at Garfield. When the students walked out that day, one of the students, John Ortiz, started calling out, blowout, blowout. I have no idea where Ortiz got this word, but other students picked it up, as did the media, although not right away, but during the course of that week, and began to refer to the walkouts as the blowouts. As the bell rang out, out they went, out in the streets, with their heads held high, with dignity. It was beautiful to be a Chicano that day. I didn't see the college students and the berets until I hit the sidewalk with my students. Girls were crying, but they bravely walked out. Everyone went out the main door. In a few minutes, almost the entire school was vacated. It was like one of those fire drills. All the kids milled around the sidewalk in the front entrance of the school. Some climbed on top of parked cars. My first concern was, where the hell are the TV cameras? Of course they weren't there because of Esparza's misinterpretation. My next thought was, what am I going to do with 2,000 kids? I had originally planned for the students to congregate in the front so the TV people could get their shots. That would be impressive. The TV reporters could then interview some of the student leaders whom I had prepped about what to say on the reasons for the walkout and about some of the demands. But since the media didn't show up, all of this was up in the air. Of course, I didn't know at the time about Esparza's snafu. As I hoped the media would arrive, I told the kids to start marching around the school. We went around and around waiting for the TV. No TV. As we marched or walked around the school grounds, I noticed that no police were in sight, although I saw some plainclothes guys with walkie-talkies. I felt relieved about this. I found out later that the cops were there but kept out of sight on the periphery of the schools. Ingalls, the principal, had alerted them, but to his credit, cautioned them about not entering the campus. This was not, however, the case at some of the other schools. The county sheriffs, for example, surrounded Garfield. The Wilson kids had to climb the school fences to get out and had problems with the cops. But the worst conflict with the police came at Roosevelt, that went out as planned at noon. Belmont didn't go out that Wednesday because I hadn't been able to get the City College kids in time to coordinate it. These reports trickled into me during the course of the day. As noted, the walkouts at Roosevelt met with police conflict. It was a totally different scene. The cops, some 40 in all, who came from the Hollenbeck Station in Boyle Heights, apparently were tougher and meaner compared to the Northeast Station by Lincoln. Some kids had to jump over locked gates in order to get out of the school. The principal had notified the cops to be there and to try to prevent the kids from walking out. The sheriff deputies called a tactical alert and came down heavy on some of the students. This proved to be the biggest and most dangerous confrontation with the police. The cops entered the campus wearing their riot gear with batons drawn and tried to push the kids back. They threatened to arrest those climbing the fence. After the kids had walked out of Lincoln and the television stations had not come to cover it, Sal Castro then got the kids to walk about 3/4 of a mile to Hazard Park. And there they went to confront one of the members of the Board of Education who had his office at Hazard Park. And they confronted him, and what they wanted to do was to tell the superintendent that they wanted the superintendent, Board of School Supervisors, to tell the rest of the Board of Education that the kids wanted a meeting with the entire Board of Education to present their demands. And so they had a rally there. People spoke and so forth, and students and so on, and they all felt this tremendous sense of accomplishment that they had pulled this walkout out. They had pulled this blowout out. The results of the rest of that week is that the following day, Belmont High School went out. Also, the police moved in there and roughed up some of the kids. On Friday, still hearing no response from the Board of Education, all of the schools walked out again on Friday. So you had thousands out in the streets again. Sal notes that maybe it's anywhere between 15,000 to 20,000 students walked out that first week in March, not only in the East LA schools, but in South Central schools because of the grievances of black students, also in support of the Chicano kids, but also in the West LA area, schools walked out in support of the East LA schools, and that accounts for the large number. It was these final walkouts on Friday that over the weekend pressured the Board of Education to agree to a meeting that following Monday with the students. And out of that meeting came an agreement because the kids said, we're not going to present our demands here at the Board of Education. You, the Board of Education, for the first time have to come and meet in our community. And so they forced them to agree 2 weeks later, more or less, to meet at Lincoln High School. where they packed that auditorium not only with students but especially with parents and community people. Out of that came the Board of Education agreeing to begin to negotiate about some of these demands. The adults came into play, they organized, and they began to a process of negotiation. As some of you know, of course, I mean, then all of that was very successful. 2 months later, however, Sal Castro and 12 others, including college students and Brown Berets, were arrested. They became the East LA 13. They were prosecuted on conspiracy charges of planning to do the walkouts. If convicted, they could have served anywhere from 65 to perhaps 150 years. Sal tells me that if that had happened, he would have become the Chicano Birdman of Alcatraz if he had served 150 years in prison. Fortunately, after they defended themselves for 2 years, the indictments were thrown out on constitutional principles, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. But events continued into that later year. In the fall, Sal Castro goes back to teach at Lincoln High School, only to be told that he cannot teach because he is an indicted felon. The students and others came to his support again. They staged almost a week-long sit-in at the Board of Education, which forced the board to reinstate Sal Castro at Lincoln High School, another major victory. Sal taught that year, but then after that was transferred to several other schools. And it was a few years later when he was then finally transferred to Belmont High School, where he finished his career over the next two or three decades as still a very committed and brave and courageous teacher. I'll conclude by simply saying that there's a lot more to the Sal Castro story that I do in my book, including the Belmont years and so forth, but it's been a great pleasure for me and a great honor to work with Sal about his story, about the events of the walkouts. I've also done interviews with some of the students, the former students who were in the walkout in their voices or in the text, but I didn't have the time to bring them into my commentary, my presentation today. But there's no question but that we all owe a great deal of honor to the walkouts and what they did in terms of opening opportunities for others, especially in the schools and the colleges and universities. So it's been a great pleasure in working with Sal and bringing his story to light, especially when the book will be published, but also by using this conference as a way of also reminding us of those events 40 years ago and how those events are still relevant to us today and how we need to learn from them and to honor that legacy. And we'll be hearing more about the walkouts, as I say, from our true commentators, but also in terms of the panel that will be discussing the former students who will talk about their involvement in the walkouts and, of course, Sal Castro later on. So with that, I'll say thank you before I present the commentary. In this presentation, there was no way that I could do justice to Sal Castro's voice, but he will give his own voice later on this afternoon. We'll now have a commentary on my presentation by two distinguished faculty members and colleagues. I'd like to first introduce Professor Tara Yoso, Associate Professor of Chicana and Chicano Studies here at UCSB. Professor Yoso's research and teaching examines issues of educational access and equity through the framework of critical race theory and critical media literacy. She is a recipient of a prestigious Ford Foundation Diversity Postdoctoral Fellowship and is the author of the recently and highly praised book entitled Critical Race Counterstories Along the Chicano Educational Pipeline. So Professor Yoso can come up here give her comments, and then we'll turn to Professor Barrera. Thank you so much.
I first want to just say what an honor it is to be here with the former student walkout leaders and colleagues with Sal Castro, to be invited by Mario, who has put together such a wonderful book that I was reading as he was reading as well. And I am just really excited to share with you all today just a couple thoughts that I have about what he presented specifically. But I think what I really most want to express is that it is really important that he's talking about the role of the profe. And we rarely consider, because we've seen so many Hollywood movies where the white teacher comes in and saves the students, the ways in which Sal Castro really flips that script in positive and empowering ways. And he did this both inside and outside the classroom. And so that for me speaks to some of the constraints of our current curriculum, even more so today perhaps than in the past. But specifically, he had identified, as had others, that the textbooks were not representative, that the structures of the school were restricting and were basically telling Chicana and Chicano students that you don't have the cultural capital that it takes to succeed in this society, that your language is something that does not belong in our schools, that all of those dichos and ethic of hard work that your family has instilled in you is inappropriate for inside these classroom walls. And what Sal was able to do was to challenge that and to help specifically students by fostering the community cultural wealth that they did have, to remind them inside and outside the classroom of the ways in which their parents had held on to those dreams, those aspirations, that they would not have to struggle as difficultly, as have as much difficulties as they did, that they would not have to work with their hands, perhaps, that they would have a college education, a chance to go on after high school. That aspirational capital is rarely acknowledged in our schools. I also noticed through the work of Professor Dolores Delgado Bernal, who some of her work is also included in the text, looking at and uncovering some of the ways in which the women who were leaders, who are not often seen at the podium, but were organizing in the background and were making those phone calls and passing out those leaflets, were really encouraged to express their navigational capital, the ways in which they were making their ways through the institution, an institution that was not created with Chicanas or Chicanos in mind. And they were spreading these pamphlets through networks that they had, as well that they had developed this social capital, these contacts that they had developed through Camp Hess Kramer and learning throughout the, they didn't have MySpace, as we saw was actually pivotal with our students in the 2006 walkouts. They also drew on the various moral and ethic consciousness, the occupational consciousness and educational consciousness of their parents who had taught them what it means to get una educación, to be una persona educada, not necessarily just someone with that book knowledge, but someone who was going to be a moral, upstanding, and just person. And that instilled in them, that familial capital instilled in them also a sense of resistant capital. Within the context of 1968 in particular, I think that Sal really kind of speaks to this in the text, that they were informed by all of these movements that were happening around them as well, and that they responded in such empowering ways. At a time right now when we are at war, it's very easy to get overwhelmed and to buy into some of those kind of party line that you just don't question. And so these students were very courageous in following by example their teacher, who's, yes, there's going to be repercussions, but you can do this. We can stand up and we can walk out and we can challenge this, and you have a right to challenge this, and your culture does belong in this classroom. And so all of these different forms of valuable capital, I think that are really incredible that Mario and Sal are recovering, that Sal has done this for decades through Camp Hess Kramer, and will continue to do so, that his legacy lives on with the many Chicanas and Chicanos who have gone on actually to serve in fields of education throughout the Los Angeles greater area and elsewhere, and that he also inspired the walkout film that Moctezuma Esparza picked up on, said, I think I will use my mistake that I made, and I will recast it in a way that no one will know that I got the time wrong. And so that film now helps us understand that that our legacy that we are carrying on of resistance to oppression, of resistance to subordination, is something that that began well before the blowouts, that they were carrying on this legacy of resistance. As he explained to them in the classroom, the legacy of Benito Juarez and the very many examples of positive role models that we have in our Mexican and Mexican-American roots. And so I'm really proud to commemorate that today and think about the ways in which we continue to recover and express and rework, revisit, revise, and move forward with the community cultural wealth, this legacy of resistance, and que viva los walkouts.
Before I introduce Professor Barrera for his comments, I thought I'd take the opportunity, because again, some of you will be coming and going, I wanted to introduce the former high school and college students who are with us today and who will share their memories at the panel that will commence around 3:30. So I want to introduce and have them stand up, and let's give them a round of applause, each one of them, as they stand up. Bobby Verdugo here. Mita Cuaron. Harry Gamboa. Henry Gutierrez. Vicky Castro. And also Yoli Rios. It's my pleasure now to introduce for our second commentary a longtime colleague and friend, Professor Mario Barrera, Professor Emeritus of Ethnic Studies at UC Berkeley and who now resides here in Santa Barbara. Professor Barrera is part of the founding generation of Chicano Studies and the author of many key texts on Chicano political theory, including his best-known book, Race and Class in the Southwest, A Theory of Racial Inequality. Professor Barrera is also a film documentary producer, including documents on Chicano Park in San Diego during the period of the Chicano movement and on a Latino World War II veterans, a recently produced documentary. You'll also be offering a class this spring quarter in Chicano Studies on Chicano Latino film. Professor Barrera.
Well, I see a couple of people got into the spirit of the event by walking out already, so you know, I thought that was very appropriate. It's always interesting to read about people, historical figures like, you know, the people that are here today, and to even see a movie about them, you know, and see their characters, the way they're portrayed, and then to actually meet the real people, kind of like a confrontation of the representation, the reality. You know, it's always a It was an interesting experience. I myself was up in Northern California when the walkouts took place, so I was not a participant or an observer of the walkouts firsthand. But I think I've been very much affected by the walkouts and the Chicano movement that in large part grew out of the walkouts, and that the walkouts in a way reflected, but at the same time also shaped. And, you know, as Professor Garcia and as Professor Yasso pointed out, these events don't take place in isolation. They're part of a historical process, and there's historical continuities that are very important for us to keep in mind. The huelga tradition that Professor Garcia referred to, the Mexican workers and the Chicano farm workers, all of that But there, from reading Professor Garcia's text in progress on this, you know, there's a lot of other aspects of politics that were going on at that time that indirectly or indirectly shaped the events of the walkouts. Among them, the war in Vietnam, which was going on at that time, which, you know, had kind of galvanized students on campus, particularly because of the draft that was still in existence at that time, the Black Power movement, the civil rights movement that had been taking place during the 50s and the 60s, Watts, kind of like an extension of that, that's specifically referred to by Sal Castro in the interviews, the Viva Kennedy clubs that had taken place back in 1960, which Sal Castro had participated in, the broader student movement that grew out of a number of events, including the free speech movement on the Berkeley campus, which is where I was at this time in 1964. All of these things sort of fed into the event of the walkouts. But so there's these sort of historical antecedents, you might say, that helped create and shape the walkouts. But then the walkouts in turn became part of the historical continuity, which then influenced a whole bunch of other things, including the aspect of the Chicano movement that I'm the most familiar with, and that's the creation of Chicano Studies and the creation of the Chicano Studies Department right here at UCSB, which offers not only BA but even a PhD in Chicano Studies. At the time that I was a student, of course, there was nothing like that at all on any campuses. This is something that really grew out of the student movements and the Chicano movement of the 1960s. The ideological emphases of the walkouts and of the Chicano movement that was going on at that time really represented in many ways a radical break from what had gone before, because people were protesting. They were protesting prejudice, they were protesting discrimination, all sorts of unequal treatment that Chicanos and other minorities were subjected to. But they were also raising all sorts of issues about identity and about taking pride in one's cultural history. And that was something that had not always existed in previous incarnations of Chicano activism, which had been going on for decades already up to that time. In fact, many of the earlier movements, such as, for example, the League of United Latin American Citizens, or the LULACs, that grew up in Texas in the 1930s, really made an effort to distance themselves, for example, from recent immigrants. You know, they really wanted to emphasize their Americanism and their citizenship, as opposed to recent immigrants that might not have been seen as being quite so respectable or American or even being citizens. So one of the very important things, and we're seeing those repercussions today, you know, every day, including in the presidential campaigns that are going on right now, was this sense of cultural pride and of looking back to Mexico and of solidarity with Mexico and other Latin American countries, and of solidarity with recent immigrants. So that was a real departure. And that then influenced subsequent generations of activists. It included the United Farm Workers, even, which prior to this time had kind of maintained a hands-off attitude toward recent immigrants, and eventually they came around to sort of the movement position and started organizing recent immigrants. But I'm going to go through all this real quick here just because of the limitations of time. But the other thing that came out of this, you know, the legacy, you might say that, depending on your point of view, you might consider all of this kind of like a positive aspects of the legacy, but there's also negative aspects of the legacy as well, because you know, like they say in physics, every movement has, or every action has an equal and opposite reaction, you know. That's also a law of politics. And just as the Chicano movement and the other movements, you know, created movement and action and direction They also brought into being their opposite tendencies. And what we're seeing today, particularly in the anti-illegal immigrant rhetoric, which you find at the very highest levels, you know, particularly Republican presidential candidates, you know, Romney, Giuliani, I mean, a number of others, have really stressed this kind of, you know, anti-illegal rhetoric. Well, in the analysis of many students of politics and scholars, the whole anti-illegal kind of immigrant thing is really a set of code words, and it's not really just against illegal immigrants. It's really against Latinos in general, and it's a reaction, you might say, a backlash against the growing presence of Latinos in American societies, not only in places like California and Texas, where Latinos have been around for a long time, but you know now you're seeing Latinos move into all kinds of states like Georgia, North Carolina, Iowa, and so forth, where that hasn't been true in the past. And in many cases, you're seeing a very strong, you know, negative reaction against this from other residents that feel threatened by that, or that feel uncomfortable, or whatever. And since it's not considered cool to take like positions against ethnic minorities, the form, the respectable form, quote unquote, respectable form that can take is anti-illegal immigrants. But generally speaking, everybody kind of understands at one level or another what's being said. And just as a case in point, you know, I brought along an article that appeared in Santa Barbara's own news press last month in the Sunday Voices section. And I brought this along because I wanted to note, this is like the opinion section where people, you know, are kind of free to express their opinions, but this particular article was given like pride of place here, you know, I mean, it was given like a prominent place with an illustration and so forth. When I first saw it, I thought, well, you know, this must be an article by some knowledgeable person, some scholar, you know, or someone with some credentials or whatever. And the only credentials that are given for this person is that they live in Goleta and that he's the son of a Polish legal immigrant. You know, when I read this article, I was really taken aback, you know, and I know in many parts of the country, you know, there's a really kind of vicious rhetoric against illegal immigrants and other Latinos, but I was kind of surprised that here in progressive, you know, Santa Barbara, you know, some distance from the border and so forth, to see this particular article. And it really, the writer of this poses a question, have the Mexican / Spanish-speaking immigrants resident in the U.S. taken back California and the West Coast from the United States? Says the answer is a resounding yes. And that takeover has been initiated by and continues to be supported by five major power groups operating in the U.S., Mexico, and other South American foreign nations. And then he goes ahead and runs these down. And he identifies big business, which is making money from illegal immigrants, politicians and their supporting law firms, the bishops and cardinals of the Catholic Church. And by the way, this is sort of the, you know, all Latinos are not Catholic, you know, regardless of what you may have heard. You know, I myself, for example, was raised in a Methodist church in South Texas. But it is true that most Latinos are brought up in the Catholic Church, and there's a tradition going back decades, even centuries now, of anti-Catholic agitation in the United States. And in a sense, this is also sort of this kind of anti-Catholic backlash that crops up very strong, for example, in the 1920s, 1930s, when the Border Patrol was brought into existence, and all kinds of legislation to restrict immigration. But the author goes on to say, he also identifies as part of this sort of conspiracy here an international gang of Hispanic terrorists known as MS-13, whose agenda is almost identical to the agenda of Al-Qaeda, which is to damage or destroy property, intimidate people, kill persons who oppose their objectives, et cetera, et cetera. And then it also goes on to identify the Hispanic advocacy groups whose stated and written intent and objective is to retake from the U.S. that portion of the Southwest that the Mexican advocacy groups allege were stolen from Mexico. Well, he doesn't give his own version of history here, but stolen is one way of putting it. You know, the United States actually tried to buy, you know, the area that's now California, Texas, New Mexico, Arizona from Mexico, and Mexico refused to sell. They tried several times to buy the area. And in the view of many historians, and Professor Garcia can speak to this much better than I can, the United States actually instigated the war with Mexico specifically to gain control over this territory. Now, maybe that could or could not be referred to as stolen, but, you know, it's not a totally off characterization. But anyway, he goes on to say, in reality, the U.S. is rapidly becoming another Hispanic nation like Mexico and other South American nations. He says, when the conversion of the U.S. to a Hispanic nation becomes complete, every U.S. citizen can expect the health, safety, environment, and standard of living conditions in the resulting Hispanic states of America to be very similar to the conditions that exist today in most Hispanic nations in the Americas. He says, instead, let's see, he says, the massive influx of Latinos is currently dragging the U.S. down toward the standard of living and levels of poor education and crime that exist today in Mexico and most South American nations. Well, you know, this is within the Santa Barbara context, this is like an extreme expression of sentiment, but voices like this are actually being heard, you know, all over the country. And I think it's important for those of us that feel like we represent a more progressive and inclusive kind of position to be aware, you know, that this is going on and that the terminology that's used of the anti-illegal immigrant and so forth is not just about illegal activity or illegal immigration. It's really about much deeper kinds of things and it's something that I think we're going to be seeing a lot more of in the future. I want to make one final point, and that's that this is a kind of a troublesome issue for me, and I think it is for a lot of other people that I identify with movements like the Latino movement. As I mentioned, the kind of goals that were being articulated by the students that participated in the walkouts and that were being articulated by a large part of the Chicano movement of the 60s and 70s, on the one hand, can be characterized as being in favor of equality in all its forms, including being against segregation and other, what you might say, structural barriers to mobility, but also had a great deal to do with affirming ethnic identity and taking pride in minority traditions and so forth. And the problem that I see here is that one of the unintended consequences of being more included in the mainstream institutions in the society, up to and including universities like this one, is that by breaking down structural barriers to mobility and including people in the dominant institutions, which is something we all tend to be in favor of, it tends to hasten the process of assimilation. So in a way, it has the effect of undercutting the very ethnic identity which the movement is also in favor of. So while these goals may not seem at first hand to be kind of in contradiction to each other, the way they play out in the United States does tend to be somewhat contradictory. And a lot of, generally speaking, I don't hear this issue being addressed a whole lot in the United States. It is addressed in some other countries. And this is why I think it's very important when we study issues having to do with ethnicity, not to confine our vision to the United States, but to also take a look at what goes on in other countries, because there are other countries where ethnic groups have much greater benefits than they do in the United States, and where the institutional arrangements are such that this kind of contradiction that I'm alluding to here, you know, is not necessarily present. And a lot of times, people like this editorial writer here, you know, will point to our neighbor to the north, you know, Canada, and say, look at this terrible thing that's going on in Canada. You know, the French-speaking citizens in the province of Quebec, you know, have this whole ethnic pride thing going here, and it's kind of threatening the integrity of Canada, and it's exactly what we don't want to happen here in the United States, and it's put forth as kind of like a negative sort of example for what might happen in the United States in the future. When I took a look at a situation in one of my works, what is going on in Canada and some other countries like Switzerland, for example, and even China, you know, I actually saw a lot of positive aspects to what people were doing there, because they weren't just trying to gain access to the dominant institutions, they were actually questioning the way those institutions worked. You know, they're saying, look, here's the way the institutions are set up. If you just become incorporated into them without advocating for change in those institutions at a kind of a deep level, then you're going to run into this contradiction that I referred to here, you know, between on the one hand equality, on the other hand cultural identity. And so I think here in the U.S., Latinos don't really constitute a majority yet, you know, in any single state, although they do, of course, in the territory of Puerto Rico, which some people refer to as a colony, but, you know, it's legal, it's a territory of the United States. And it's kind of interesting to take a look at Puerto Rico and to see, you know, how the majority Latinos there have kind of related to this whole question, and there's actually been a lot of conflict among Puerto Ricanos as to what the future of Puerto Rico should be with respect to the United States. I myself, you know, given the demographic trends in states like California, where eventually, you know, Latinos, and in a not too distant future, Latinos will be a majority of the population here, it's going to be very interesting for me to actually see what comes out of that politically. You know, is it going to be a continuation of what we've seen in the past, or is there going to be kind of a tipping point reached at some point, you know, where the existence of a majority population in a state is actually going to shift the focus, and people are going to start raising somewhat deeper kind of demands in terms of the institutions, but, you know, only time will tell. So, thank you.
I want to thank Professor Yoso and Professor Barrera for their commentary. We're going to take about a 5-minute break or so, and there's refreshments over here while we set up the panel with the former students. So everyone kind of take a deep breath, stretch. There's coffee, there's lemonade, there's some cookies back here. So 5 minutes more or less, and then I'll call everyone back. Okay? Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.